This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We depend utterly on fossil fuels, especially to grow our food. From natural gas comes the millions of tons of fertilizers. Oil provides herbicides and pesticides. All is planted and harvested with oil power, driven, shipped, and flown to your table. For now. Until fossil fuels become too expensive, too rare, or too polluting to use, we have only a short time to find other ways. Wes Jackson offers some good answers for our food supply during peak oil and climate change. Raised on a Kansas farm, Jackson is a biologist, a geneticist, and a botanist. In 1976, he left university life to found the Land Institute, which he still heads. He's going to explain natural systems agriculture in a powerful speech given to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, USA. Then we'll hear a different assessment of the potential for sequestering carbon in the soil and biochar from the Australian carbon cycle expert Dr. Michael Ropak. This Radio EcoShock program is part of our Big Picture series of solutions. I'm Alex Smith. Let's begin with Wes Jackson, recorded November 4th, 2011, in Washington, D.C., for Radio EcoShock by Jerry Williams.
Well, thank you. What a pleasure to be here. I want to first of all tell you what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about biofuels, considering that the average American in calories consumes the equivalent of about 26 gallons of gasoline a year. Let's say we don't eat for a year and turn all of our food into ethanol. That's 2 gallons a month per person. That's for the trucks over the road, airplanes, the postal workers, whatever. If we take all the wheat straw, corn stalks, peanut shells, grass clippings, maybe another 2 gallons a month. And depending on how you calculate it, stop all exports, and there's another 1.5 to 2 gallons a month. I'm not going to talk about biofuels. Nor am I going to talk about what peak oil means. A few years ago, I was getting ready to give a commencement address to some graduates of a college, and they were surprised, you folks wouldn't be, that the 10-year-old has lived through a quarter of all the oil ever burned. The 22-year-old, 54% of all the oil ever burned. You folks know that, so I'm not going to talk about that. I am going to tell you, though, some of you may not know this, that soil is more important than oil. And as much of a non-renewable resource as oil. Soil is the product of geologic activity. There's a very good reason why Australia is a poor continent and is going to stay poor. Its last geologic activity was 65 million years ago. We have mountains that lift up, and we are the most fortunate nation of all because of the Pleistocene, the ice that gouged the nutrients off the Canadian Shield, and fortunate that it parked it through that 1.8 or 9 million year period north of the Gulf of Mexico, so that we get the water at the right time, the nutrients. This was not paid attention to when Nikita Khrushchev came to the United States in 1959 and visited the Iowa cornfields and was wondering what they're doing in Iowa to have those kinds of yields. Well, we had a good Pleistocene, and we happened to be north of the Gulf of Mexico. So the day will come in which we will quit treating soil like dirt. The day will come in which we will recognize what the most important invention of the 20th century was. In 1909, two Germans, learned how to take atmospheric nitrogen and turn it into ammonia. Fritz Haber and Carl Bosch. Vaclav Smil, the nitrogen scholar who's written on it extensively for decades, reckons that if we did not have Haber-Bosch, essentially all of it fueled by natural gas as the feedstock, 40% of humanity wouldn't be here now. So here we are at 7 billion and counting. And I have to say, my friends, that soil is too often overlooked as being as much in danger and as much a problem for our future as oil. It's pretty hard to convince us in our time constantly looking at peak oil, which we should. But essentially, my message is this. If we can keep ourselves fed through this long, dark tunnel that we're going to be going through as we try to get in control of our appetite for fossil carbon, if we can keep our soils in place, all of the gains that we have had at the beginning of what I call the fall, the biblical fall, if you wish, at least that myth, of 10,000 years ago when we started agriculture and got at the young, pulverized coal of the soil, the carbon of the soil that made civilization possible, and then 5,000 years ago, the forests that made possible to smelt the ore for the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, and then, of course, the coal 250 years ago, Drake's oil well, 1859, natural gas used for power a little after that. And I'm going to show you slides. And then I hope at the end I will convince you of the necessity and the possibility of a sustainable green revolution. And I think it passes the test that it's not grandiose. Here is, as I see it, an important chronology. I start with what I call the 3.45 billion year imperative. All organisms are made of carbon, and we go after energy-rich carbon. If it's bacteria on a petri dish, Drosophila flies in a flask on mashed up banana and yeast, or deer, you know, deer without predators. That's what we do, the 3.45 billion year imperative. Well, 10,000 years ago, we got into the first pool of energy-rich carbon that we began to use at a rate that was faster than the rate of renewal. It's been estimated that the continent had about 6% carbon in our soils. They're now down to about 3%. That was, in my view, the beginning of climate change, the soil carbon. The second pool I already mentioned, 5,000 years ago, the forests. Then I'm going to move on down the Industrial Revolution, the third pool, Drake's oil well, the fourth, and then natural gas. But now move over. In 1492, something else happened. And that was the opening up of land with Columbus. In 1803, the Louisiana Purchase, and then in 1862, the Homestead Act. In around 1600, something important happened, the Copernican Revolution, which paved the way for the scientific era, the likes of Francis Bacon, René Descartes, and that's where the knowledge is adequate worldview came to be. Bill Vitek and I edited a book on the virtues of ignorance. And it was predicated on the idea that we assume that knowledge is adequate to run the world, but we all know we're billions of times more ignorant than knowledgeable and always will be. And so we're arguing the need for us to go with our long suit. Let's have an ignorance-based worldview. And if we do, that will be a whole different way of thinking about how we go about the world. Out of that knowledge is adequate worldview, we have created a lot of problems. So I'm here today to talk to you about ignorance and how ignorance can help us into the possibility of a sunshine future. And then I'll talk a little more about the institutions that have come along that can help. All right, in May of 1862, Congress passed the Homestead Act. And so now the land is available for people if they just go out and prove up on it. It's interesting that as soon as July, we put in the Land Grant College Act, the Morrill Act. And this established the land grant colleges devoted to the mechanic arts and agriculture. In 1887, the Hatch Act is the coming of the experiment station. And then in 1914, we have the Smith-Lever Act, which is the extension service. So there it is. We're on a new continent. And Dan Luton, friend of mine at Berkeley, is dead now, in 1969, wrote something like this. We came as a poor people to a seemingly empty land that was rich in resources, and we built our institutions for that perception of reality. Our educational institutions, our economic institutions, our political institutions, all predicated on poor people, empty land that's rich. Now we've become rich people in an increasingly poor land that's filling up. And those institutions don't hold. We patch them up. We give them a lick and a promise. But they don't hold. And that's part of our modern challenge. The Louisiana Purchase in 1803 was a territory that they could flood into. The Kansas-Nebraska Act was 1854. A week or so before that act, for the ratification of that, my own great-grandfather came into Kansas and took up land, had to be moved for a little bit because he is settled on Indian land. But imagine that huge expanse of land that's lying out there beckoning like a liberation. And so what do? Given our 3.45 billion-year imperative, given the fact that we're land animals, given that we want to harvest contemporary sunlight as our food, we pour into that landscape and appropriate it and convert it into agriculture crops where appropriate. Well, that is a part of the mentality that came with us and is part of the mentality that I think we're all questioning today. In 1948, this is Norman Rockwell's county agent, it all had come together. The land-grant college, experiment station and extension, and here is the land. This happens to be in Indiana. There is Dad back in the shadows with a cat on his shoulder. There is the horse still in the barn. There's Grandpa looking in. There's the dutiful 4-H girl measuring the girth of a Guernsey, looking on as the county agent measures the girth of a Guernsey heifer. There's Brother with his poultry project. And there is Sith with her sewing project. And Mom looking on proudly. Well, what do you see in that photo, in that painting? I think Rockwell was only painting what was, but he also was painting what got writ large. Expertise and youth are central in that painting. Tradition and experience are peripheral. And therein lies a tale that I think we can all imagine. Well, I learned the name of that county agent, and I called anybody in the phone book by the name of Ripley in that town in Indiana, and I got a man, I think he was in real estate. I said, can you tell me about the family? Sure, he says. He gave me the name of the kids. Can you give me the number? He gave me the number of Gamma Sue. I called Gamma Sue, the one that's holding the 4-H record book. Are you on the farm? No. When did you leave the farm? 18. What about your sister? She left too. What about brother? Well, brother died during the farm crisis of the 80s. Dad had been killed by the bull. Anybody of your family on the land? No, we ran it out. This happened all over agricultural America. So one has to ask why. Let's go back to 1948. The global pesticide production really began about that time, and sales followed. In spite of Silent Spring, 1962, the pesticide industry has doubled, had doubled, and doubled again. Nitrogen, going back to about that time, in spite of Haber-Bosch, in 1909, remember, we had World War I, we had a depression, then we had World War II. Finally, we get it together and start the takeoff. So nitrogen, more irrigation wells get put down, phosphorus, and so on. And of course, there is the diesel fuel that made it possible to ship the horses off the farm to become dog food. And here is the anhydrous ammonia tanks that replaced the recycling of the manure. And also about that time, the farm sales accelerate. Here is an auction. And the loft of that barn is the fuel tank. The bottom of that barn is where the straw would be mixed with the manure and urine. But look what happens when you no longer need that fuel tank and you no longer need a place to manage the urine and the manure. The barns go down. And the only reason those barns stay now, whatever one stay, it's due to nostalgia, primarily nostalgia. This is a microscope slide with algae cells, photosynthesizers, and then there are the concentrators, the tube animals. Now, move down to the next slide. That's looking down on the canopy of a tropical rainforest, and there you see the canopy as the photosynthesizers, and the trunks and limbs are the concentrators. And then move on down. This is looking down on Kansas in the 1930s, and here this is a 3-mile stretch. But there are the fields that are the photosynthesizers, and then the farmsteads and the villages are the concentrators. You reduce all three of these to a common scale, and the radial arms going out from the concentrators to the concentrate-e are about the same. Well, then what happens when you introduce fossil fuel into your system? Highly dense energy brought into your system, the farms start getting sold. So I think there is a general law. General. High energy destroys information of the cultural and biological varieties. So Norman Rockwell's canny agent, that cultural capacity for growing food on contemporary sunlight is mostly gone. We will get the horses back faster than we'll get the people that have the know-how to farm using the contemporary energy. This, to me, is the primary food crisis.
You are listening to Dr. Wes Jackson as he develops a deep theory for the reform of agriculture to survive the twin challenges of peak oil and climate change. The natural farmers, he says, are gone with their knowledge of living in immediate time. They are replaced by carbon-powered food production, a short-term phenomenon. Jackson, founder of the Land Institute, has a deep solution to revolutionize agriculture. This is Radio EcoShock.
This is not true for everybody, but by and large, you have to be raised to farming. Well, let's just draw a deep breath for a moment. Put that behind and allow it to creep up in your minds a little bit now and then from time to time. And let's think about the last green revolution and what those assumptions were. There were about five of them. My friend Angus Wright, who wrote that marvelous book, The Death of Ramon Gonzalez, The Modern Agricultural Dilemma. This is sort of Angus's summary. And he has studied the Green Revolution, particularly in Latin America. Here was the assumption: low productivity is the problem. We need higher yields per acre. Now, soil degradation was factored in, but as a cost, in the emphasis in there on input-output ratio. The gap between the social reality and the scientific challenge was more or less ignored by the big players, the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, and so on. A second assumption: traditional techniques by countless farmers were considered more of an obstacle than a resource. These people need to get modern. The third: technologies are neutral. When persuasion fails, it's time to use compulsion. Four: agriculture is to serve as an instrument for the advancement of industry. So adoption of the Green Revolution package is essential. Need more chemicals? Build a chemical plant for fertilizer, pesticides. And finally, agriculture is not vitally linked to wild nature, and that'll become a point of departure later on in this talk. So here's been the number one killer of our continent, the corn plant. The yields now, well over 200 bushels per acre. When I was born 75 years ago, it was around 30 bushels per acre. This plant, though, has taken over as probably the number one killer. That's soybeans. Corn went from 70 million acres in 1 year to 90 million acres as a result of the subsidies on ethanol. The ethanol subsidies right at $6 billion this year. Soil erosion has gone up, but we haven't got the estimates in on that yet. But if you look at the Corn Belt, Minnesota up there at the top, Wisconsin, that is really brown, is soil that's exposed in April, right when the rains are coming. That which is yellow is because of averaging these colors. And all of those states do have soil erosion. It's just that the brown shows it up more because it's almost 100% there. That's corn and soybeans. And this is not a rare scene. This happens to be in Illinois. And notice that the corn is barely up. So there it is in Iowa. Well, is this just the problem in the United States? No, this is in Ethiopia. And this is in a Green Revolution area. That whole field was once wheat, but it wasn't wheat for very long. The original vegetative structure had been disturbed. Well, we are humans. We humans are clever. We will invent minimum till, no till. We will use pesticides to kill off the weeds. Then we will drill right into the stubble. And sure enough, the conventional there is milky water there at the lower part of the picture. That, though, that is minimum till, no till, is nice and clear. That's wonderful, except for one thing. The nitrogen level in that water is twice the acceptable level of the Environmental Protection Agency. So what's wrong? And of course, half the nitrogen applied on the upper Midwest ends up to help make a dead zone, which is now about as large as New Jersey. And it disrupts the fisheries, of course. So here's the 3.45 billion year imperative. We go after energy-rich carbon to either eat, and we also, in an exogenous sort of way. Here are the five pools that we have gone through in our journey since the break with nature, merely some 400 or 500 generations ago. It's interesting that there's always been an acknowledgement of nature having practical value. In the formal culture, namely the literary and the scientific tradition, it comes as a series. For instance, Wendell Berry went through the history of this, going all the way back to Job, and Virgil And then in the literary tradition, in English literature, you can see it in Shakespeare, in Spenser, in Milton, and finally in Alexander Pope. Alexander Pope's poem, The Epistle to Burlington, says this: "Let nature never be forgot, consult the genius of the place in all." A-L-L. So the genius of the place in Kansas is the prairie. The genius of the place in the tropical rainforest is the rainforest. The genius of the prairie, that ecosystem, is able to receive precipitation. And during the great Dust Bowl years of the 30s, the prairie lived, the wheat plants died. On the other hand, the genius of the place in the tropics, that system is designed to get rid of water fast using giant engines, like giant engines, pushing that water back into the atmosphere. And so two different ecosystems, we plant soybeans in both places. So Homo the homogenizer has been around for some 10,000 years. And in the formal culture, after Pope, after Alexander Pope, the idea of nature having practical value went underground, and when it surfaced, it was around 1900 with Liberty Hyde Bailey. After that, Sir Albert Howard and J. Russell Smith, his book on tree crops. So we have that. Wendell says that comes as a series. It just pops up. But, he says, in the common culture, it's a succession. In other words, it's like a stream carried along, but then in the formal culture, it pops up as a series. Now, 1935, Hugh Hammond Bennett, the founding chief of the Soil Conservation Service under Roosevelt, there was our first opportunity to move the idea of nature as measure into the formal culture. And so never has an organization been put together with more esprit de corps devoted to the common task of saving our soils. It was energetic, lots of imagination, total support. Roosevelt called in Hugh Hammond Bennett one time. He says, "Bennett, you give me more trouble than anybody in my administration. Bennett, I get calls about you. I get people complaining. Keep up the good work, Bennett." So here is a tropical rainforest, a perennial mixture or polyculture. Here is desert scrub, a perennial mixture or polyculture. Here is one of our typical scenes in Kansas, tall grass prairie, a perennial polyculture.
When Radio EcoShock returns, Dr. Wes Jackson of the Land Institute will explain his solution for food production in a time of reduced fossil fuels and a changing climate. We'll also talk about carbon sequestration into the soil with Australian carbon expert Dr. Michael Ropak of the Australian National Science Agency, CISRO. We'll be back in a minute.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.